Welcome to the Non-Breaking Space Show from Austin, Texas. I'm the internet's own Christopher Schmidt. And on today's show, we welcome Nathan Curtis. Nathan Curtis co-founded 8Shapes in 2006 and is passionate about interaction design, information architecture, and front-end development. He specializes in design systems, consulting for teams large and small, regularly writing about and speaking at events worldwide. Co-hosting this week is a friend of the show, Michael Godbolt, senior design developer at Microsoft. Before we get started, some things I'd like you to know. Make plans for CSS DevConf 2017 this October 9th through 11th. It's more than just CSS. We cover topics like web components, React, working with design systems, Webpack, more. So grab your tickets now and learn from Chris Coyer, Wes Boss, Mina Markham, Harry Roberts, Sarah Drasner, and many other great speakers, all in New Orleans. Tickets are on sale now at cssdevconf.com. The UX Design Newsletter is a weekly list of articles, tutorials, inspiration handpicked by me. Sign up at uxdesignnewsletter.com and have the best links of the week sent to your email. Set it and forget it with a Non-Breaking Space Show newsletter, so whenever a new show is ready, you'll get sent an email right away. You can sign up at newsletter.nonbreakingspace.tv. Of course, you can find show notes and links discussed in today's show at nonbreakingspace.tv. And be sure to follow me on Twitter at Telejct, T-E-L-E-J-E-C-T. As always, thank you for telling others about Non-Breaking Space. Now, on with the show. Okay, well, I appreciate you guys for both being here today. So we have Micah. Hey, how are you doing?
Good.
Good. And where are you? And where are you from?
Yeah, I'm hailing in from Redmond today. I'm on campus, actually starting a little bit of a new role. This is actually day two of a new role for me here at Microsoft. Nice. So it's kind of exciting, and fortunately, they have nice little phone rooms for me to dive into and take a call. So it's working out well.
That's pretty awesome. Cool. And also with us is the guest of the show is Nathan Curtis. Hi, Nathan.
How's it going? I'm coming from Fairfax, Virginia, from my home office.
Well, thanks for being on the show again. Nathan, could you just describe a little bit about your background for people who might not know?
Sure thing. I've been, since school in the mid-90s, involved in the development of software, and particularly UI design and UX, and as it's evolved. And since about 2006, when I started my company 8Shapes with my partner Dan Brown, we have been working with clients almost nonstop in working design systems and incorporating them into product portfolios and so on. Certainly the practice has evolved a lot in the last 11 years considerably, but it's been a lot of fun thinking in components and visual style and patterns and all the things that we do day to day. So that's a big and now only part of my consulting practice. I do that full time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm always amazed that you've been doing these design system work for the time that you have, and the rest of the industry seems like we're finally catching up. It seems like it's been like the last maybe 3 or 4 years where design system and design system thinking has really caught on. It must be kind of funny for you to say like, oh, finally, everyone's figuring out what I've already known for so long.
Well, I guess sort of. I mean, there's been a big catch up with standard practice of most people thinking about approaching their design, but I stand on the shoulder of giants much bigger than me and people at Yahoo and even before the call, we were talking about frog design and they were doing design systems in the 90s with Dell and they were using terms like atoms and molecules. So all these concepts have been around for a while. And I think that a lot of companies, if you think back even 10, 15 years ago, companies like Cisco, Yahoo, eBay, the big titans of the age, they were all doing systems. And so they were all experiencing this value of doing these standards at scale that I think a lot more companies at even a greater to smaller in scale are starting to really incorporate into their standard practice. So it's great to see, but I've just been a passenger in the train that's been trucking on for a long time.
Well, one question I have, like, I just want to do a compare and contrast of like the time. Like, what type of deliverables would you give to a client, you know, back when you started out, like 2006 or 2007, that would be kind of like a design style guide or whatnot? Like,
is what, some of it was the same. Most of the libraries that I ran into in the mid-2000s into the early part of this decade were still founded upon a code library. I mean, they still had, if not as well, nearly as well organized base of visual style of color and type and icons and space and so on. They still had all of their objects, whether they're called modules, portlets, components, patterns, whatever, in a big library so you could chunk together an interface really quickly. And so I worked a lot with Sun. I did some work with Yahoo, and both of them have really robust component libraries. And at the same time, they were still paired with this design community's exploration of more principled patterns that didn't necessarily have code behind them, but talked about when to use a particular pattern, like an accordion, what the guidelines were, and helped designers make good judgments based on sound principles and evidence to use these patterns. I think where it's different today than where it was in the past is, I mean, like the book I wrote now 8 years ago, I almost advise people to not read the first half of it because it talks about using InDesign and all of the modular tooling that InDesign has to make wireframe deliverables that you publish in a PDF. We totally stopped doing that in 2011. Nobody does that anymore.
Thankfully.
But it was great. I had this kit. It was downloaded by 60,000 people over the course of like 5 or 6 years. It had value in the way that the design was done in that age. But now we don't really do that. Now people are talking about tooling Sketch and then increasingly weaving essentially the source of truth in data, the source of truth in JavaScript and the actual code components together with Sketch in a more automated way. And I find those connections being drawn a lot more fascinating, but it's generally the progression of the practice, frankly.
Yeah, I think one thing's interesting, we've come a long way with design systems. We've started to get design systems incorporated into every level of application, to, you know, large media sites, to smaller sites, you know, top to bottom. And you, I think, kind of mentioned it right there about getting into Sketch and like the connection of data and Sketch and design. But what do you think that next kind of threshold that we need to cross over with design systems is? What is that next kind of breakthrough that's going to push us to the next level of design systems?
Oh, dude, if I had a magic ball, I'd be starting a company and making a product. But I actually think that both the teams building bespoke systems in-house, as well as some of the design tools of the day, I mean, Sketch is one, InVision and UXPen and all these other companies pursuing incorporating system practices into their design software are evidence that we're upping our game and they're becoming modeled better. And the way that we make decisions as designers is being modeled better. And to me, I draw the most passion out of the modeling aspect. I'm an information architect by heart. I called myself an IA from, 1998 until UX was invented as a term. And so it was like 8 years. And I think about abstractions and hierarchies and value property pairs and all these things. And so when you start to describe a design language like that and weave it through a lot of increasingly composable bits, I think that is what's unleashing people to be more serious about it. So you see a tool like Brand AI or Salesforce's Theo with tokens and so on, they're relying on or depending upon this foundation of data to describe a design language. But what I think is going to be next, and we're starting to see in some of ours, is how can you use that data to tune the pieces that you build? That is, instead of offering a button, the button works across 4 background colors. And there's a small, medium, large version of that button that has 5 different types and a hierarchy of buttons. And so all those different combinatorics lead you to what before was a very intimidating array of choices that you had to guarantee was accessible in every combination you chose. Now that we're increasing the practice of how we build these things and document them and so on, it's more realistic to produce these things at a high level of quality that meet those criteria, and also a high degree of flexibility to the degree that people need to be able to tune them or tune the dials in their how they apply them in their own experiences. So yeah. That, to me, the multidimensionality of that and the combinatorics of all that is something that I'm probably going to geek out on for another year or two.
Yeah, it looks like we're able to start quantifying just about everything that we do inside of a design system, all the way down to, you know, the RGB value, RGBA value of text on top of the background button. And then, as you said, over multiple themes, over multiple sizes, over multiple font sizes and font weights, it is pretty amazing that we can now start talking about having automation that tests all the accessibility and the contrast ratios from one theme to the next, and even get to the point of being able to generate these themes programmatically and automatically using some type of AI to be able to kind of go through all of that data, come out with a pleasing theme on the other side. It is interesting once we get everything into that data layer, the things we can next do with it.
I totally agree, and you touch a little bit on automation too, and there's automated regression testing of visual artifacts within code, and we're even doing an upgrade on our own visual diffing tool this week, and that enables us to create one page that we call like the kitchen sink, that we automate the generation of, say, all the different button variations that we have. And I joke to people and even say it was a little overboard that our buttons kitchen sink page was 92,000 pixels tall. So seriously, that's a lot of buttons and a lot of different combinations, but now we can predictably just sit with that, live with it, and automate all the testing of it, and we'll know if we ever broke it. And
yeah, because it doesn't matter if you have 500 button combinations, you don't have to test them manually.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's definitely a different world once you get into that.
I think I would wonder too if part of our future sees a mapping of different platforms and really the tooling that we build to build systems, the tooling we build to describe a design language, the tools we build to essentially apply that and scaffold it to UI elements, and have it really be mapped so that you can automate React, Vue, Angular, whatever, I don't care what your framework is, that there are paths and patterns that you can use to generate all those, as well as solve the even tougher challenge of across actual native platforms too. Not that you'd want to always adopt these same things across native platforms, sometimes that's lunacy, but there are a lot of things that I would wonder that we can increasingly tool beyond the hex codes and the border radii and the spatial constants that we might use to things that are more composed.
Yeah, looking at the entire, some kind of component UI object as entirety rather than a single value, and seeing how all those values relate, and make sure that the difference between a base state and a hover state is enough value and works within the context of the rest of the component. It's going to be interesting to see what we do as we get all this data into a single layer, then start looking at that data and evaluating that data and seeing what you can do with that. Even tweaking the data to see what kind of, Google's famous in just changing the color value of something on their homepage by this minute amount to see what kind of response they get. So being able to have that kind of control over a system would be interesting to see what in 5-10 years you're able to do to really fine tune, what that proper UI is about. Now, I know you mentioned and brought up some of the different platforms. And I know personally, platforms such as Vue and React, Angular, personally, it's been really interesting to see how bringing those JavaScript frameworks into a design system has really changed the way that I've looked at design systems. And I'm wondering if you've had a similar experience as you started to work a little bit more with those in the last few years.
Actually, my experience with them can tend to be more limited. I don't have as much depth there. And the reason is when I'm brought into client engagements, when essentially a company brings my company in, we set up a strategy, we make a first release, we often concentrate on HTML and CSS. And we rely upon pockets of development within an enterprise to actually then take that and wrap their React around it, or wrap their whatever other framework around it, because we're not yet at a place where in any of my clients really, there's a consolidated framework that everyone's going to use. And frankly, I'm just trying to make the case to make a system, to get a few different people of engineers and designers coming together to create a squad and have capacity to do this as their job, that to commit to building a React, Vue, Angular combination of all these things is totally unrealistic. And so this helps me create relationships with different pockets within the community, and that actually helps with adoption, frankly. But also, it starts to, you talk about the future and where these go with those frameworks, it starts to make me cognizant of the fact that we're not going to have a design system in the future. We're going to have a system of systems in the future. And it's going to intimidate some folks, and some enterprises may mature more quickly than others. But the fact is, we're going to tease apart some of these concerns and be able to reuse design decisions as tokens within front-end layers and reuse basic descriptions of HTML and CSS across multiple different layers. And so all these are different connections that are actually indicative of multiple systems that rely upon each other. Does that make sense?
Yeah, a bit. And I think maybe what I'm teasing out here is an experience that I've had over this last year going from a purely marketing site, from redhat.com, of really all we were concerned with was getting content onto a page so that it could be read and consumed by users. And I was really concerned about kind of the authoring experience and just getting static content on the site, knowing full well that if you were to try and take the same system and apply it to a major application, that there'd be major holes within the components and how they're built and how they're consumed and kind of the entire process in which we are building them. And then contrast that to coming here to Microsoft. We actually are in a situation where the majority of our applications are actually moving towards React. So we do have that convergence where we have, you know, dozens of large applications coming to a single framework where we can actually build a single design system that's wrapped within that framework, and starting to see kind of the fruits of that. And kind of for me, what that next step is of a design system not just having and creating consistent look and feel from one site to another, you know, as we have different applications that are adopting the framework, but also consistent functionality. So the way that keyboarding works, the way that you're able to move up and down a list with arrow keys or select it with the enter or space bar or hit escape to escape out of things, We're starting to see that we're able to move a lot of that functionality into those component pieces as well, and the amount of benefit you gain from that is way more than, okay, I don't have to create another button. I don't have to create a button which also has a drop down menu which also can take, you know, on click handlers and so on and so forth, and you know, all that effort that you put into, you know, the visuals and functionality of the button is then just consumed and assumed, and then you can move on and kind of again build on the shoulders of giants once you've done that. So yeah, I was kind of curious to see if you've come across that experience to start building some of those out. I know there's also conversations of, you know, obviously getting these things tied into frameworks can be a little troublesome because you never know if, you know, that framework is going to take a nosedive or something and you need to move to another. So even like the future of web components and the notion of being able to like build out your own set of primitives within the browser and kind of what that future looks like. For me, I know that's really quite exciting to see where eventually we'll be going with that. Hopefully not tied into a single framework in the future.
Yeah, I am certainly not one that can predict the direction of those beyond, goodness, they seem to change all the time. And so we need to be nimble and be able to adapt to those changes. One of the interesting things I heard you talk about was the recognition that as you grew to have at least the benefit of having React as a potential framework that most teams are using, but also the spread of that system across a potentially widely diverse array of experience types. Applications and sites, motifs of different kinds of applications. And one of the things that I've been challenged is the degree to which adopting teams are off-put by a perception that there's not enough there that's specific to them for them to warrant it. And there's some sort of balance or some sort of threshold that you reach with a component library, particularly for web-based experiences. Let's limit at least ourselves to that conversation. That everybody needs buttons, forms, vertical list groups, tabs, probably. There's really typically 12 to 15 components that everybody needs. And then there's a whole bevy of 25 other content components. And there's a whole bevy of 15 to 20 application components. And they start to diverge. But there's this conversation around, do we share enough to adopt the same library or not? And I'm finding myself asserting that more often than not, yes, there is. I'm curious, are you finding any instances where people are saying that library is too distinct from mine because of site versus app or because of the motif of the app and that they really diverge as an adopting set of products to do something different?
Well, I think one advantage we have is that the primitives that we have are, again, as you said, buttons and lists and navigation and drop downs and radio buttons and really those simple things that just about any application is going to need. But I agree that there's a separate challenge of, can we build something that's universal enough that anyone would want to pick up and use? And that also gets into design. When you have all these different groups with completely different design organizations, are those designers communicating enough to have the same design solutions to be able to use the same technical code solutions to solve those? So if one person's all about accordions and someone else is all about, you know, tabs and pivots, it's going to be tough to be able to build something that's going to meet all those needs unless those designers can come together and decide to solve those problems in the same way. And an interesting thing with our approach is we're completely federated at this point. We have really no core, like, focused, dedicated team to the product. We rely on all of the various teams, development teams, to contribute back to the project to fix bugs and add features. But the thing is, we are used to that model. It's on GitHub. We're used to pull requests. We're used to the collaboration and reviewing pull requests and everything. And so on the developer side, we've been really good at that, coming to a consensus about how we want to accomplish something code-wise. Designers, on the other hand, I don't know if they've had that opportunity to work in that open source community where they understand how do they collaborate? Like, what's that process like when you have two different teams that they're trying to solve similar problems, but then they come up with completely different solutions, again, like accordions versus pivots or something like that. And how do they have the tools? Do they have the mental, do they have the experience and kind of just the mental constructs to be able to walk through those and come to common solutions? Have you experienced any of that with some of the disparate teams that you've worked on?
I think it varies by enterprise. Sometimes I'll step into a very immature enterprise that has virtually no community of engineering across products and similarly very little community of design. More often, I'll be brought in because one of those two communities is forming well, and there's an advocate of system, essentially a system enthusiast or a system sponsor that says, we're going to make it, and it's going to be grounded in that. More often than not, it's design, frankly. I will come in and find, if not at the scale of Microsoft, which for most of my clients is an outlier. I mean, Google, Microsoft, IBM, GE, those are massive companies. But let's take it down a notch or two to most of the other companies out there. And there's a healthy amount of critique going on across product teams and even across lines of businesses, that there's a connectedness of designers that are at least exposing each other to each other's work and providing valuable feedback. The injection of a system can both be a boon and a threat to that conversation and design. It can be a boon because suddenly they realize that they can share some things and borrow solutions from other designers and maybe even other engineers. But it's a threat too because suddenly the nature of the critique changes and you inject of not just is your solution good, but do we agree on the solution and do we agree that we should share the solution? Because that's actually oftentimes the forces outside of that design community that are getting placed on the design community. Why isn't this thing cohesive? And that can generate friction within designers. And so they don't have and I am a designer, we often don't have the constructs to make those decisions in black and white. Or you don't have a collective model of how you're making those decisions around range of background colors, around small, medium, large, and which components you're going to actually allow for those small, medium, large hooks to be applied to buttons and lists and so on. And so until you start to have a system be a foundation to provide that framework for making decisions together, it's just it can be people talking past each other. They don't have the coded truth to rely upon and refer to make concrete decisions. And so that's why I feel like design might struggle a bit more relative to the communities of engineering that you might what I perceive you talking about.
Having that experience of working in a collaborative environment, especially collaborative asynchronous across, you know, different states, different countries, whatever the case is, have you found there's any within the design community any good tools or approaches or things that they can do to try and, you know, come to that solution? You said that oftentimes the designers are able to, you know, share between from one team to another. I know personally within here, most design teams work within, you know, quite a bit of a silo. And for them to, you know, cross-pollinate usually takes quite a bit of effort. Are there things that you've seen other teams and other companies do that worked well for them?
So there's a few, I don't know if things I've seen, but let me phrase it as characteristics or qualities of a design community that tend to be correlated with better systematic decision-making. One is management that values the sharing across product teams and creates opportunities for their, carves out space, time, and opportunities for their designers to convene and to share their work and possibly even rotate across different assignments to gain visibility across product lines or across sites and applications or whatever the lines of division might be. The second is those then start to foster a strong culture of critique. Frankly, when I come into a system engagement and I know there's an existing critique that 3/4 of the people in the workshop raise their hand and say, I attend at least 60% of these critiques, I'm thinking to myself, okay, that's healthy. That is the place where we're going to get visibility. And that might be the place where we make systematic decisions, or we identify them and have a different venue to then make them. And so the culture of critique is an important one. The third one that, frankly, I think is really important is you have to have connectors within that community. Oftentimes, I will seek out for a systems team when we're starting a system or we're going through some formative operating periods where there is central capacity dedicated to it. I will look for designers that are well connected and have the assertiveness to inject themselves to connect and to provoke quite good, meaningful questions. And so I'll, to protect the innocent, let's say there's this guy, John. John is the person that's actually talking with everybody else. And they're in that Slack channel that's responding and probing more and more about those things. And they're the person that can then map what those conversations are, not just to models that the system has, but ways that the system will prioritize making things and put it in a context of, yeah, that modal that you want to make that is of a consent form, we don't need the consent form modal as a thing in the system. We have a modal, we have a UX pattern for a providing consent. You can combine those two things to create the solution for your product. And the person nods their head in Slack and says, yeah, that's great, that's all I need. I feel like our community is met by that. So is that getting a little bit at some of the signals or qualities that you might see in a design organization or culture?
Certainly. I know we have, like within our team's channel, we have a channel for Fabric and specifically a design channel, which is quite active. I think there's a tendency for, hopefully there's a good tendency for people reaching out, asking those questions before they try and build something, you know, net new. Like, are there components that I could use? Is there a way that I can accomplish this faster? And I think that's usually the thing that we want to try and promote is what's the most efficient way that we can build things. Because when you get into a situation with we have a design team that's like, how can I make something that's just all me and all like showing off it? When you have designers that start preening and trying to create something that's so special and brand new and amazing, kind of missing the point. I mean, the reason that we do this in code is so that we don't have to write those 500 lines of code again. There's no pride as a developer to write that code again that already exists. So if we can start seeing that within our designers as well, I think that's a huge win for us, being able to have people that say, like, my end goal is getting over here. And if I can get 70% of that knocked out of the way because I can pull in existing components, that's a huge win for me. And obviously, it's a huge win for the system as well.
It's interesting you refer to that, the in preening as a flavorful word.
I was trying to find a way to say that appropriately, yes.
No. It's helpful, though, because I think there's a perception within the product development communities or teams making things digitally, that's often the motive that designers have to make something shine. And yeah, you might have someone fresh out of school where they were in school or in some other environment, essentially encouraged to do that and were evaluated as successful by their degree to do that. But in a professional setting, any designers with any sort of seasoning I see struggling to remain consistent with the system because they don't have, or with standards in general, is because they don't have the visibility or awareness or knowledge of what those standards are, and a healthy enough respect that those decisions were made with enough evidence or thinking around them to warrant reuse. And so in the Slack channels that I participate in, we too have three channels. We have a core team channel that's the private one. We're doing all our Jira tasks and coordinating and that kind of stuff and asking for pull request reviews. Then we have an engineering channel where all the engineers are asking code-related questions. That's probably where you're hanging out more, or where you're like a systems advocate champion in there. But then we have the design channel, and I monitor the chatter in that channel and identify how many people are asking for help because they're asking a question that is indicating that they haven't yet found in the system if the system supports something or how to do it if they know that it's in there. And so it's really more findability or perception of, does this thing have a focus state? Have you solved for the third tertiary button, whatever, to have this disabled state or what have you? And they just haven't figured out how to do it and they need help. Or their question actually implies a feature request. Whether it's as esoteric as the modal consent form or something more practical like error messages. If you didn't get like an error message in your first release because you had a certain amount of capacity, where is that thing? And so in that sense, I find that designers are looking to do the right thing. Surveys I do exhibit that designers believe in cohesiveness. They value the shared experience in a journey that spans many products. But it's more their ability to have transparent visibility and awareness of everything that's going on that inhibits them from achieving that in their space. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, designers, it's certainly a lot for me to learn, not being in that space as much. And I kind of assume that everyone wants to be at that same level of reusability. At times, certainly, I see a lot of it. And sometimes it's kind of that when you see something to build, you see a blank canvas and you start just, creating inside of that blank canvas. So, I hope to certainly see a lot more of that and try and figure out what are those tools that we can use to make it easier for a designer to reuse those components. I think it comes back to like, Sketch and XD and those visual toolkits that make it easy to compose experience and find all those things that they might have thought I'll just create my own input box. Like, oh no, we actually have an input box that has, all the various states and even, as you said, like error messages and those types of things, to be able to reuse those so that you don't have to be creating those completely, brand new every single time you touch them.
Right. Well, I feel like I need to jump in here and defend the designer.
Go for it.
I feel like, I totally understand that there's preening, if you will, is a good term for it. I mean, I went to a company and I was talking about design. This is before design systems are as well known. And literally, this designer would not stop talking about a folder tab in their design and how she designed this and the developers wouldn't implement it because they already had a folder tab design and it was working so well, and at the time, in order to use it, they would have to rewrite the whole entire application module just to accommodate the CSS because the CSS wasn't as robust back then. And I was like, at some point you just let it go, it's a folder tab, maybe a year from now we can look at it again and punt on this one as my partner likes to say, is this the hill you want to die on? It's pretty much. So, and designers, I think they've, in some cases, you run those issues, but sometimes I feel like, designers are willing to work with developers and work in this system. And my point is that I still run into people who are designers and they don't want to work with Git or GitHub because they don't understand the branching and even the basic stuffs with GitHub. So they don't have that culture of like that you referenced earlier, Micah, about like a collaborative effort on design. And I find that we had an episode with Built Sketch, I think our last episode talking about Sketch, about how there's actually going to be as a resource, like there's actually going to be like, you know, a Git for Sketch in terms of like, you know, designing and stuff like that. And I felt like that's great, and that's going to allow people to like, you know, I think with your idea of like having a designer work across different departments and teams, I think that's going to help out a lot more, because that type of experience isn't as well known, especially in design schools, maybe now, like as we're talking right now. But I feel like, you know, as personally as someone who went to design school back then, like collaboration was, you know, necessary, critiques were necessary, you know, to like, you know, there's nothing like a good critique that tears your assignment to pieces after you worked like a month on it. And so there's like nothing, you know, there's no ego involved with that after a while. So but yeah, so I think there's designers do want to do that, but you know, the tools aren't as easy, you know, I hate to say like GUI based, but they, you know, are easy for them to push, because like, you know, they understand the visual language. And also I think just in general, I think there's been a disruption in how designers operate, you know, from web design starting out, from this waterfall of Photoshop and everything like that. So now we're really getting into like automation. I love the idea, like we talked about, like automating design systems and the design system of design systems that Nathan mentioned. I think that's awesome, but you know, and I was so worried, like, oh, well, where's the designer in this, you know, in this point? Like who's actually controlling the knobs and dials?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's really, I think, a relevant question when you're talking about systems in particular, is who's controlling the knobs? Because designers, while equipped with such a variety of skills, including critique, coming out of school or based on past experience, when they find themselves in the pursuit of a system or participating in a community that's making a system, they aren't necessarily, you can't assume they're equipped with product management discipline. That is, the discipline around releases, the discipline around making roadmaps and priority decisions, the disciplines about the impacts of adding feature A3 that is really expensive and barely moves the needle compared to A2 and A1, when if you add B and it's really cheap and it's going to help everybody and have a huge value impact, that suddenly they aren't equipped to make those comparisons. And so it's up to a system team or community, if it's fully federated, to help understand the direction and vision of what the system is, promote what it needs, promote how it's going to grow. And if you don't have that sort of product management layer or sheen to what your system is trying to do, it's going to fall prey to a lack of designers feeling really upset that their preening wonderful tab thing you're talking about, folder, whatever, isn't in the system. So you can't assume that designers are going to be equipped with those skills.
Right. And I do say, like, there's, you know, a designer, like, you know, has the visual language, but also I think the, you know, there's nothing works best than, a testing with real users and having everyone see it and process, and also with real data, like, you know, with analytics and stuff like that, to say like, hey, yeah, your tab idea like is great, but, you know, we don't really need it because like everyone still knows it's a tab. We don't have to go through and have this beveled tab, and like no one's gonna like lose sleep over it. So, but
yeah, I'm curious, Micah, if you actually have a story to tell there, because I don't often have the best answer to the question when a product manager I'm trying to get to adopt the system asks, so have you proven that these all work well? And because my answer is like, yes, they're resilient to unpredictable content. Yes, they're accessible. Yes, they're fully functional. Yes, they have the highest level of visual quality. And then they're like, no. Does it solve the user's problem well? And is it functioning well? And have you tested this with users? And I'm like, oh, wait, I've made tons of buttons, but I haven't tested those yet. Do you have that as a criteria, or how do you confront some of the adopters of your system that question the validity of what the system has on offer because of the lack of evidence of proving it in real context?
I have one quick, I guess, funny side story on that. This whole, like, do you have evidence? Do you have prior knowledge? When I first dove into the design system at Red Hat, they asked me, hey, you know, can you start this up and start building these components out and everything? And shortly after that, they asked, so how many times have you done this? And I had to tell them this was the first time, because I think there are a lot of us that are in those spots where we know this is the way to do something. And literally, this is the first time that we'll have a chance to do this specifically. It's like, you know, it's like painting blue houses. We've painted houses before, but maybe not blue. This is going to be a little different. I've read painting experience, but not blue yet. But I think we'll get through it. Long tangent. All right. So, but getting back to the quality and basically the provability of what the work we're doing, I think there's two values that you can pull out of a design system. One is to the people that are building with it and to the end users that are going to be using it. Real quickly to the ones that are building with it. I know we saw some dramatic cost savings. I mean, after a short amount of time, we're able to look at just the basics of how much does a person cost to do this task? How many tasks are we negating because of the fact we have the system that keeps us from having to repeat those? And quickly calculate that out to the millions of dollars that we would have spent having to do this by hand. I think those are really easy to show because we have systems in place, we count hours, we have, you know, salaries and hourly rates and those types of things. So I think that's pretty well established. And I know at Red Hat, we're really had that nailed down. And I don't think at Microsoft, we have any question whatsoever that, you know, nobody needs to spend another 200 hours writing another list component or something. But on the user side of getting out to users and having them use the products and experience those products, I do believe there's a lot more validation that could be done to bring that data back and show definitively that that's the case. Anecdotally, I think it's pretty obvious that especially as you start getting to getting your design system into a framework that is able to move not just from consistent colors, consistent shapes, but also consistent interactions, I think that's really where the users benefit, where you can go from we go from application to application built by completely different teams, completely different, even maybe like underlying tech stack, like maybe one's, you know, an Azure backend and one's connect to S3 and they have different technology stacks in the middleware, but just all built with the same UI kit, that every single user that comes there has the same experience of like, oh, I can tab from the search box, you know, down into the search results. And if I use the up and down arrow keys, I can, you know, go up and down between all of the items in the search results. And if I hit enter, that would bring me directly to it. And then from there, I can, you know, so on and so forth. I know personally, I've jumped into products, even products of ours, where I'm expecting certain interactions when I, you know, keyboard around or something, and it's not there. It's jarring. It's this like, I thought I knew how to use this application, but this isn't, you know, reacting the way I expect it to. So having a user, you know, come into those situations and go like, oh, this feels just, it's a completely different product, but it feels just like every other product I've used within the suite of products. I think there's an insane amount of value there that's for the customer, whether that's myself trying to use our applications or someone that's looking to possibly pay money for our applications. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of testing that could be done. And I know we do a good bit of user research when making some of our decisions about what goes into the design system. But it really be really neat to see after a lot of that's deployed, what's that impact? You know, what's the feedback from users? What's their experience like? And how has that changed for them as they're now using products that all adhere to that same type of UI system?
Yeah, and that's where it gets back to like who's controlling the dials. And then also like if you're like, you can do like automated and AI and something that you can actually, you know, apply, making sure the users are happy. Then like, do we look at quantifiable or, you know, the user impact? And so, which is, you know, not too crazy to do. I think we have the tools to figure that out.
And I think that I was reminded as Michael, you were describing some of those things, some of the experiences I had where actually we did blend in research well, and there's really three ways with one client or a couple clients that it worked well. First was, the system team sets up prototypes that emulate the use of its components in fairly realistic scenarios, and you test the component. We don't really do that much when we're making systems because more often our stuff is primitive enough that it feels too ad hoc and not realistic enough, which means the second place is you have to defer to the product team's knowledge of what they've tested and learn from it. as opposed to feeling like you put something out in the wild and then you ask all the product teams to do the research later. They've probably done research already. And if you've got a design system primarily meant for most of your apps, for most of your products, but your marketing site wants to use it too, if they say red cells is the primary button, we will not use your blue button. We won't use it. And then it becomes this big objection using the system. You say, oh, actually, that's one line of CSS. We can make another variation that gives you your e-commerce red button. And it's dash dash e-commerce as a modifier class. Done. Thanks. And we move on because they had all the evidence for it. It's like if I'm working at Marriott, I'm not going to tell them what icon to choose for the primary features of a hotel that they test 20 different icons in one sprint and find the best one for whatever property of free Wi-Fi or breakfast that they want to promote or fosters a good decision of their buying customer. They're going to choose the icon. I'm going to provide a platform of a system to propagate those icons to all the other products that can benefit from that same signal. And then the last thing is I will look for organizations that have a mature research practice that is a service across the enterprise rather than embedded researchers that just live on a product team or a UX person wearing research clothing. Instead, if there's a research practice, we had one library stand up, and its biggest success in my eyes wasn't actually the visual style and components we published, but the fact that each of those pages of color and buttons and forms and typography had an overview guidelines tab and then a second tab called research, where we had taken all of their templated research studies where they had called out findings on color and type and buttons and forms, and we essentially labeled all those as PDFs and then figured out a basic CMS to show those results, show the findings that were listed on the findings page because they were really mature in their practice and repeatable. And we just started publishing all the documentation and said, you want to look for the evidence, it's right in the second tab. And suddenly everybody had access to research they didn't even know existed because it was an organization of 150 designers. And suddenly there becomes this efficiency and scale and horizontally serving practices of systems and research that starts to dovetail together. So amid what was otherwise a very challenging project, that was, for me, a big win to marry those two things together.
Yeah, I think the research is the one of the amazing things for me is at Microsoft, we definitely do a ton of it. It is, I think, is still a bit more siloed within products and whatnot. But at least to come across the situations where you're like, why is this button this way? Or why is this way? Like, it'd be so much easier if we could just do it this other way. And then for the designers and the researchers to actually be able to come back and say, we did some testing. Here's the background and research on it, and this is the best solution that we came up with. But I think also a point that you kind of made is as far as like the marketing team might want that red button, and oftentimes you also have to realize they have a completely different user base. They have a completely different group of people that might be coming to their product that maybe red identifies with them much better than your primary blue. So I think one of the things I was thinking of when you were talking about that is I come from where I was at before was actually OneDrive and SharePoint specifically, and that's where Fabric was kind of born. And an interesting thing I've seen is that the design system was born out of a single product. So it kind of took on a lot of the visual styles of that product and started fanning out to all of the other products to adopt. The OneDrive and SharePoint, their design system, probably a better way to say it, is their style guide is a bit more limited. I mean, they have some really specific ways they want to present their UI specifically because they've done research. But the system we made is way more capable than what their style guide needs. And that's because we've taken it and federated it across multiple organizations, where each of those organizations have very widely different needs. Like the only time that OneDrive and SharePoint needs a dropdown is in a command. So like a command bar at top, it's the only time they have a dropdown. They would never have a dropdown in like a primary button or something like that. And they're like, why is there a dropdown or primary button? And our answer from a system standpoint is, well, because these other partners inside of their UI, this is a decision they've made that works for them. So we've made it a system that can support all those different needs. So kind of back to the color scenario, One product owner, one product might not need all those different color variations, but you need a system that's able to support all those different types of users. Whether that's multiple themes on one page, whether that's various themes going out to each of the groups, whether it's that's Excel wanting everything to be green, whatever the case is, we want to make sure that we have a system that's able to support that. Which is interesting because it kind of turns the system that we're building into even more base layer primitive items of this is the button and the functionality. The styles on top of it, we might want to give a good set of like presets, but knowing they might diverge quite dramatically from product to product to product as they have their own research and needs have gone into that.
Well, it's interesting you point it out that way because there's a certain philosophy or principle at play of what goes in a system or not. And I am of the mindset that if it only is for one product, if that e-commerce button was only going to be used by one product, I'd say you are welcome to depend upon our SaaS, create all the buttons, and add that line of CSS code for you to do it yourself. It has no business being in a system. But I'm curious, I have a rule of thumb where these conversations escalate to being system worthy. And if it's two products, I start to pay attention, but I'm not fully convinced. If it's three products, it's time to start talking about it. And if it's five products and it's something that it's relevant to the system scope and mission and timing and capacity to make things, it belongs in the system. If it's at five, it's like a no-brainer. I'm curious, do you have a similar scale? Do you have a point of view on once it's two, it goes in the system, no doubt? I mean, where do you come from on that, both of you?
Sure. I don't think it's a number thing for us. It's a couple different factors that go into it. One is what's the impact on the system? For instance, we would never just make an extra green button because one random user needs a green button. Specifically, what we've done with buttons is we've made them extremely flexible to take in custom themes. So, because once you make a green button, you're like, oh, now someone needs a dark green button. And now they need a dark green button that hovers white instead of, the lighter green color and so on and so forth. So we've made buttons that you can pass in a completely custom theme into. We've moved into CSS and JavaScript, so that just gets mixed in right as the component gets rendered on the page. And that means that any user, instead of needing, if the blue and white buttons in our standard theme don't work for them or they want to go completely different direction, it's very easy to customize those and use those any way that they want. So part of the decision there wasn't like, oh, well, two people need it. It's, well, can we make a button that's way more capable that it's going to meet their needs and anyone else's needs that might have that same question? Because again, OneDrive SharePoint, we've got our two buttons. That's really all the product needs and all the designers are working within kind of that reality of the two-button system. But we've made sure we have a design system that's able to produce many other flavors of that. So if it needs to be customized, it can be done so. I think where it comes in is when you want to introduce a completely brand new code, see a completely brand new component. I think that's the question of how usable is this piece of code? Is this code that's only going to be used in your product? Or is there a chance that adding this code to the system would be able to benefit not just your product, but other products within the system as well? And yeah, if it's just two, again, I think that might be one thing. Well, maybe the two of you should just collaborate because that maybe is really specific to the two of your products. But yeah, as soon as it gets to three, and I think three is kind of that magic number, as long as it's not, there's certainly things that throw red flags, but as long as there's no red flags on it, say, bring it in and make that part of, the offering that we have within the system. What about you, Chris?
I don't have that problem yet. So
you're a lucky man.
Yeah. I will say, I do want to ask you, Nathan, just what are your, you mentioned rules of thumb for integrating a component or design, thing into the design system. What are your, do you have any tips or tricks for people who want to get a design system going into their organization, but haven't been able to be successful? Do you have to do much convincing? And if so, any techniques or?
Generally what I see, and then I'll place where I usually get involved into what I see, is systems are an evolution and reflect the maturity and scaling of a design org. at the beginning, there might be someone who sees value in systematically approaching design or engineering, and they start to do things in their own space and their own product team on their own dime to start to exhibit those things. It might be a single person working on a single team, and then they start to see Salesforce Lightning. They start to see Google Materials spec that's gorgeous, or they start to see these patterns in the industry and tell themselves, I need to organize my work like that. And so they start to do these things, and then people like managers or product owners or leaders in the organization will see that and say, go ahead and do that in your spare time. But that's not a system to me. That's just a person doing work systematically, and it's not going to sustain or be adoptable by lots of other people because there's no support mechanism. There's no formality to it. Teams will then have this phase transition where those managers, product owners, sponsors, whoever, start to endorse the pursuit of that, see value in the structure of that, and want to essentially carve out time of an individual to start to serve other people. And so, take a quarter time, do that work, or do it on Friday afternoons, or hopefully not just that. But I get involved when a team is working on setting up a more formal system pursuit. They need to compose a strategy. They need to form a team to make things, whether that team is borrowed from lots of other teams or becomes a formal squad. And at that point, you've got a systems team making a system based on a strategy that's endorsed, it's sponsored, and it is going to have some sort of pivotal moment where you're going to release it and tell other teams it's ready for use. And even before that, you're telling some early adopters, go ahead and start using it so we can see where we need to refine it. And you even have an alpha release where you're saying, here's our Hello World color page and our button page or what have you. And that progression from an alpha to just demonstrate basic things to a beta that you're actually getting some early people to adopt it, but you're not making commitments to a breaking change. And then a final 1.0 where you start to get semantically versioned at hardcore. They may not be using those terms. They may not be talking about it like that, but that's the progression of a mature system that people can depend on. And so that's that progression there is when I'm getting involved with groups, and then I'll sort of taper off and be succeeded, and they'll just live on their own and live with the system from there on.
I think that's a good stopping point, actually. But how can people find you on the internet and talk more about design systems?
So I'm really usually in three places in the design system community. I'm on Twitter. Of course, you can follow me at Nathan A. Curtis. And I'm tweeting about 50 to 60% of the time on systems, but I'll admit there's a lot of Arsenal Football Club and other pursuits in there. The second place is that I do a lot of writing on Medium, and that's where people get a lot of content from me. Mm-hmm. And I love getting the feedback from that too. And then the third place is we've got a design system Slack. It's, I believe, designsystems.herokuapp.com. And you put in your email address. It invites you to the Slack group. And as of this morning, I want to say there's in the low 3,000s of people in that community. And it's a really vibrant community that has all sorts of topical channels of interest. And all the people we talk about and representing all the systems that are in play in the industry, most of those people are in there. Yeah. And so we're having really good chatter. So that's it.
Cool. Yeah. And I will say, I love your articles on Medium. So that's, I think we had you on an online conference for E4H a while back. And I think that's one of the reasons why, I really wanted you to speak is because you had such great content on Medium and of course, you've been working on design systems, I'm not gonna say forever, but for a long time before most people were. And, so you have great content and you've been in this space for a long time, so it's been just great talking to you today. So,
it's been a pleasure being here. I love having the passionate chatter with the two of you. It's a lot of fun.
Cool. Awesome. I hope to talk to you soon.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot.